Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publicize your book. And there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in East Asian Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Ed Pulford, one of the hosts of the channel. On the podcast today, we have Adam Brooks, a former BBC foreign correspondent who reported over many years from China, Indonesia, and the United States. And he'll be talking about his new book, Fragile Cargo, China's Wartime Race to Save the Treasures of the Forbidden City, which was published this year, 2022, by Chatto and Windus. At the geometrical centre of China's capital city, Beijing, is a museum, the Palace Museum, housed in the sprawling golden-eaved imperial complex, sometimes known as the Forbidden City. Dramatic enough on their own, these roofs shelter a staggeringly huge collection of art and artifacts collected over hundreds of years by the multi-ethnic emperors who lived in the palace. The collection has justifiably amazed millions of both Chinese and non-Chinese people who visited the complex in recent decades, possibly not so long ago, with the aid of a Roger Moore voice audio recording for Anglophones. But equally amazing is the fact that these paintings, vases, scrolls and carvings, or most of them at least, are still in there at all, given the tides of imperial collapse, civil war and foreign invasion which rocked East Asia in the 20th century. Adam Brooks' new book tells the story of the survival of these treasures, as the title aptly puts it, in the face of tumultuous events unfolding in China from the 1920s to the 1950s. The evacuation of thousands and thousands of cases of mostly very fragile objects from Beijing and their meandering journey to safety deep in Western China is an amazing tale of the efforts of brave and studious curators who ensured that their cargo was protected from, as the book puts it, bombing, plunder by Japanese troops or by bandits, weather, damp, pests, poor roads, turbulent rivers, rotted joists, and accidents of all kinds. But this is also, in Brooks's beautiful telling, an object-mediated story of the end of the Qing, of the lightning expansion of the Japanese Empire, of the lingering presence of British, American, and French gunboat empires in China, and of nationalist and later communist parties seeking to define the country's future. On their improbable journey, the palace treasures seem to visit almost every major and many non-major locations in China, and ultimately also Taiwan, lending the narrative a balance between the grand scale of continental cataclysm and the intimate world of the ink painter or carver. But to help us navigate then between these scales and many other stories besides, we have Adam Brooks here, so I'll say welcome, Adam, to the podcast.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, great to have the chance to speak to someone on a compelling topic that I think manages, as I say, to take in so much. But perhaps I'll begin by asking you a bit about how you got interested, maybe not only in this specific episode or series of episodes of history, but in China generally, in East Asia and the like.
I started out paying attention to China, or trying to, way back as an undergraduate. I studied Chinese at SOAS in the 1980s. I went on to get jobs in journalism, I think, kind of based on the fact that I was a Chinese speaker, and I was one of the kind of few reporters in the pool who would be able to function in China in a meaningful way. I worked for the BBC for a long time, for BBC News, and for them I was a foreign correspondent, and I spent, 8 years in China for the BBC on and off. While I would never want to portray myself as any kind of China expert or China scholar, I seem to have spent a lot of my career looking Chinawards. When I kind of quit full-time journalism, I wrote commercial fiction for a time. But then my wife and I encountered this story. We heard it in Taiwan, of the evacuation of the imperial art collections from the Forbidden City in the 1930s, and this incredible journey they made around China. And we were not very familiar with it. We hadn't heard it before, and that surprised both of us, because we're both quite familiar with 20th century Chinese history. And when we looked around in the English language sources, we couldn't find a full account of that story. And equally, as I dug into it a little bit, I found that quite a lot of primary source material was appearing in China over the last 10, 15 years. So it just seemed to me that the time was ripe to take a shot at writing a full-length narrative account of the story. I wouldn't want to say it's the history of the story. I'd say it's a history of the story. It's a narrative telling of it.
Mm. Yeah, well, as I say, it takes in so many different aspects and uses, I think, this sort of single strand to draw in a great, gallery of different aspects of that fascinating period of the country's past. So that's something that's very compelling about the book. I just wonder, though, given that you spent this long period, reporting as a journalist, presumably largely on current affairs at the time, did sort of history and an interest in the past, whether distant or near, feature much in your journalistic time? Did you have the space to kind of explore an interest in this alongside your reporting work?
One tries, I guess. I don't think I was ever particularly efficient or effective at doing that. But, when you're wandering around Beijing year after year, and when you're trying to, I guess, represent the Chinese Communist Party, to depict it for audiences in Europe and the United States, you have to try and contextualize it. We in the Anglophone world are very, I think, our understanding of China remains pretty impoverished. I don't think we're very China competent at all. I don't think our publics have a great sense of what this country is or where it comes from. So that act of contextualizing, of just trying to invite your listener or your reader to approach the question of what is this thing we call China, and when we talk about China, what are we talking about? I think that is part of the journalistic function. We do try to do that, but it's obviously much easier and much more efficient to do it in the sort of longer form textual writing.
Great. I think that's all spot on. And as far as the sort of trajectory of things from that point at which you alighted on this story, as you say, or that kind of tale of these objects' journey through China, which we'll get onto in a second. How did the actual book project then take shape in terms of the research, in terms of the scene setting, and the way that you came to frame the actual writing project?
It took shape via years of me floundering around trying to work through the source material. I hired a researcher in China to try and sift out the good source material from the rubbish. And this story, the story of the imperial collections and the history of the Forbidden City in China, has become rather kind of mythologized. You know, it's become rather mystified. It has a kind of mythic status as the founding story of the Palace Museum, perhaps one of the, you know, the one of the greatest cultural institutions in China. And to try and get away from that and to demystify the story and find out what actually happened rather than what happens in the later heroic tellings of the story was difficult. And there's a lot of really awful material flying around. So I hired a researcher to go through everything, basically, and then push in my direction what he thought was the most reliable source material. So that kind of was useful. I set about reading, which I do slowly in Chinese. The more difficult stuff I got, helped with professional translators. And then I tried to talk to the two palace museums, the one in Beijing and the one in Taipei. The one in Beijing was not desperately willing to talk to some random ex-journalist in the United States who wanted to write a version of their most treasured story. But the Palace Museum Taipei was very open and incredibly helpful, and they were very enthusiastic. So I was able to go to Taipei, meet curators at the museum, meet their archive people, and I was introduced to surviving eyewitnesses who remember the Second World War in China and remember this story, and I was able to interview them. So that was the kind of research basis of the thing, and I then tried to craft it into a narrative.
Great, yeah. Well, I was going to ask about that actually, the involvement of each of the two Guogong, right, the two palace museums in Beijing and Taipei, and noticed from the acknowledgements that there's a more of a Taiwan focus. It's probably not too much of a spoiler alert to, not too much of an alert is needed to mention that the collection is in both those places in some proportion. Anyway, it really tells that you had this kind of humane and human contacts with that story, in addition to just the objects themselves, which have their own lives. But that's great. We'll jump in then perhaps to the kind of beginning of the book, in which you offer a sort of prelude, a sort of deeper time historical preface, if you like, to the existence of this collection. The Emperor Qianlong in 1765, sitting in this hall with all of these many treasures around. But perhaps on the most basic level, could you just give us a overview of what the treasures were? Why were they so important? You know, you mentioned the mythologies that have perhaps emerged very recently, but you know, what are we actually talking about here? These treasures.
Well, what we're talking about is a vast amalgam of objects and texts that resided in the palaces and storehouses of the Forbidden City, and the roles that they played there, as I understand them, and the scholarship here, I think, is still trying to figure out what these things were and what their function was. But as my understanding is that they played a variety of roles. Some of them were aesthetic and decorative, others were representative. A lot of the roles of these objects were rituals. So, for example, much of the porcelain would have been used in rituals. Many of the objects had sort of metaphysical significance, ancient bronzes carrying inscriptions from the Zhou period and deep antiquity. You had musical instruments, you had sets of bells, you know, you had a big collection of clocks that were imported and brought into the palace. So overall, these collections, I've in the book I use the term collections plural to try and introduce the idea that this wasn't a single collection assembled in the way that a European collector might collect. This is a rather different thing. And it was deeply tied into the role of the emperor as the center of the universe. It was evidence of the emperor's mystique and centrality. And crucially, what's very important is that these collections were hidden. They were a private sort of horde, if you like. I do use that word in the book too, a private horde of emperors. And they were not to be seen by ordinary people. And much of it actually remained in storage. It wasn't on display in the Forbidden City. It was stored away. So it was everything from paintings to encyclopedias to the Qing archive, you know, the history of the Qing emperors, to carvings in jade, to jewelry, to cloisonne, to thrones, to swords, to portraiture, to genealogy, you name it. When they catalogued it in 1924, they found 1.17 million objects to catalogue in a catalogue of 28 volumes, which gives you an idea of the scale.
No, that's quite amazing, but I think very revealing and appropriate that you identify it as collections or as a sort of, you know, group of things, a very large group or multiple groups that didn't attain this kind of single coherence perhaps until more recently. I believe you call it a journey of meaning or a journey in meaning, I should say, that the objects undergo, interpreted in certain ways at different times. And it's that sheds light, I think, so richly on these different historical periods and how things how things were unfolding around them. So yeah, you've kind of brought us up to that that period in the early to mid 1920s. There's a lot of kind of, you know, historical context to fill in between that and Qianlong and the end of the Qing Empire and so on. But into the 20th century, this collection or collections are undergoing or are embarking on a very significant journey of meanings after the imperial collapse and into the kind of foundation of the Republic of China in 1912. So could you say something about where we find these objects at that point? What sort of state are they in? And how is a project launched to exactly, as you say, catalogue them and kind of bring some coherence to this vast, sprawling group of things?
So after the collapse of the Qing, you know, Puyi, the last emperor, remains in the Forbidden City with his sort of shrunken retinue of people. The palaces themselves are falling apart. Weeds are growing up in the courtyards. There's piles of ash and cinders. The trees are falling down. You know, the place is in terrible shape. In 1924, Puyi is kicked out of the Forbidden City by the warlord Feng Yuxiang. And Feng Yuxiang's new government, the Beiyang government in Peking, decides that it needs to take possession of all the old imperial possessions. So it sets up a committee called which is usually translated as the Committee for the Disposition of the Qing Household. And this committee decides that it must catalogue everything that is inside the imperial precincts in the Forbidden City. So they set up inventory teams, mostly made up of scholars and students from Peking University. And in December 1924, in the sort of depths of a dark winter, Peking winter, these inventory teams, all bundled up in scarves and gloves and padded jackets, make their way into the empty, silent Forbidden City, and they start cataloging object by object by object. And they are the first people to see these collections in the round, to look at them holistically, and to actually get a sense of what's here. Much of what they see, no one has ever seen before or hasn't seen in centuries. They begin to understand the sort of hugeness, the colossal nature of what's in there. And they assemble this huge catalogue. In just 1 year, it's decided that the Forbidden City will become a museum. And a year after the inventory begins, the Palace Museum is founded on National Day 1925, October 10th, and throws open its doors to the public. So it was an incredibly quick transition from this imperial hoard to a national museum with objects now open to public view and symbolizing something totally new and different and performing a completely different role in Chinese public life.
Yeah, the speed of that is really astonishing, and I guess reveals the extent to which so many of the ideas that ended up feeding into how the Republic kind of came together, or at least how some kind of post Qing or post-imperial era came together were brewing perhaps for longer than you know, their sort of actual enactment would suggest, that these kind of ideas that you need to have a museum of the kind of national treasures and so on, presumably was around, I guess, in the minds of some of these influential figures before that. But onto the figures themselves, and as we move kind of into the body of the book, we hear of a couple of important characters who remain important throughout the entire book, Zhuang Yan and Na Zhiliang, two kind of slightly more junior, perhaps, curators, each richly fleshed out with their own characters. But perhaps the most sort of enduring, significant, and again, spoiler alert, but I suppose ultimately tragic figure in the book is a scholar, Ma Heng. So could you say something about him, a person you term the shabby professor in chapter two? Who was Ma Heng, and what was his sort of involvement in this project?
So Ma Heng was born in 1881. His father was a Qing magistrate. He grew up just outside Shanghai. He married from youth. He was a very precocious kid. He was deeply interested in traditional Chinese scholarship, you know, in the antiquarian tradition, which means that he was looking at ancient inscriptions. He was cutting seals. He was looking at objects. He was looking at bronzes. He was reading poetry, all that sort of stuff that the traditional Chinese scholar, the antiquarian scholar, did. Didn't have much formal higher education. He was privately tutored as a boy. He married into a terribly wealthy family in Shanghai. And for 15 years, he worked as a businessman in the family businesses in Shanghai, which ran from hardware stores to match factories to silk factories. And he lived this gilded life in the concessions in Shanghai. But he always yearned to be a true scholar. And in 1917, Peking University was undergoing this massive expansion under Tsai Ing-wen. Lots was happening there, and Ma Heng saw his moment, and he left behind his gilded, wealthy life in Shanghai, and he moved to Peking, and he took a job in Peking University, initially working on archival stuff and also teaching equestrianism. He was quite the horseman. So he was teaching Peking University students how to ride to start with. But then, you know, word of his scholarship became widespread, and he was offered jobs as a teacher of epigraphy, philology, and history. He helped establish the Institute of Archaeology inside Peking University in 1922. He was instrumental in trying to lay the ground for modern archaeological practice in China. He was part of that whole movement. Throughout the 1920s, he was very involved in the larger archaeological projects across China, and was advocating for legislation to make sure that archaeology became part of a state-administered project, and that China's archaeological patrimony was the patrimony of the state. So he was very much a modernizer from that point of view, as well as being a traditionalist. He was on the inventory teams in 1924 in the Forbidden City, and by the end of the 20s, he occupies a senior position in the Palace Museum. In 1934, he's director of the Palace Museum, and he's the guy who oversees and manages and runs the entire enterprise, the packing of the collections in 1933, and then this extraordinary journey that they go on for the next 16 years. So he's the central figure. He never wrote much of a memoir, so we don't really see a lot of his own words. We only really see him from the outside, and he remains a little bit of a mystery and a bit of an enigma. But he's well portrayed in other memoirs, and we have a strong sense of his character and who he was. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. You mentioned at one point that a lot of his life was covered mainly or reflected mainly in poetry, right? Which he did write throughout certain periods of his life. And it's only sort of refracted experience in poetry that we get a sense of his firsthand voice, at least up until quite close to the end. So definitely an intriguing figure. And as you've now mentioned, yes, what the person who oversees this entire endeavor to evacuate the entire collection only, what, 7 or 8 years after the Palace Museum has opened in the first place. So could you say something about the kind of background of that decision, what it was that ultimately caused the kind of choice to leave Beijing, and, well, also maybe some numbers about how much stuff actually ended up getting moved.
Yeah. So this was actually one of the biggest challenges in the book, was trying to pin down exactly how that decision was made. And I never really succeeded in figuring out who or when it was decided that these artifacts would be evacuated from Peking. By the late 1920s, the Palace Museum is coming as close as it ever does to flourishing. It's doing okay. But in 1931, Japan occupies Manchuria. 1932, you have a huge outbreak of fighting between Japanese and Chinese forces in Shanghai. And crucially, for the first time, you have Japanese aerial bombing of a civilian population in Shanghai, prefiguring the entire Second World War. You know, it happened in China first. Large parts of Shanghai burn. Thousands of civilians are killed. From our perspective, crucially, in the middle of that bombing, the commercial press building and the Oriental Library are hit by Japanese bombs. They sit right in the center of Shanghai. They're hit by Japanese bombs. Thousands of vital source texts, paintings, objects in the library and the museum are destroyed. Suddenly, people are realizing this is what aerial bombing does. It doesn't just hit military targets. It kills civilians. It eviscerates cities and society and culture, right? This is the potential of aerial bombing. The following year, 1933, the Japanese then are leaving Manchuria. They're moving down through Ruhr province, and they're coming right down to Shanhaiguan and the Great Wall. So Japanese troops now are only about 3-4 hours from Peking by road. Japanese aircraft are overhead all the time. If you're sitting in the Palace Museum at this point, clearly you're worried, knowing the history of the Japanese in China, knowing the history of foreign armies in China and their propensity for looting and stealing and destruction, you are going to start thinking about, is the Forbidden City safe? At some point in 1932, the board of directors of the Palace Museum decide the imperial collections are not safe. We are going to have to evacuate them to somewhere. We don't really know where, but we're going to start packing now. So they buy in thousands of wooden crates and they begin packing using cotton wadding, hemp cord, rice husks, heavy paper. They figure out a methodology for packing these incredibly fragile, irreplaceable objects, porcelain, jade, you name it, 1,000-year-old hand scrolls on silk. And they end up in the Forbidden City and in other museums in Peking, they end up packing 19,500 cases, inside which reside, I think you can say as a kind of shorthand, about 250,000 objects and texts. It's hard to know how to count those numbers. It depends how you compute them. But something like 250,000 objects, perhaps between 1/3 and 1/4 of the contents of the entire Forbidden City at the time. And those objects were the objects that those curators at the time deemed to be what they thought were the most irreplaceable, the most valuable objects of the lot. 28,000 pieces of porcelain, 8,000 paintings, 8,000 works in jade, an entire copy of the Sikhu Quanshu, the Qianlong Encyclopedia, in 76,000 volumes, the entire Qing archive taken from the Forbidden City, basically the history of the Qing Empire. And so you can imagine just a colossal number of objects, but also a colossal variety of objects, all of which have to be packed and then later conserved in different ways. So it was a monumental undertaking. And they finally actually started taking those cases out of the Forbidden City in February 1933.
Great. Yeah. Well, you give us a sense of that scale, but also one really kind of you know, intriguing part of the book is that there are certain objects that sort of resurface periodically. A scroll painting, early snow on the river, these objects which seem to defy all of those categories you've just mentioned, which are these huge stone drums of the Qin era with these engravings on them that kind of periodically loom up as these impossibly heavy, unwieldy things, as well as much more delicate items like this red glazed Ming era ewer kind of jug type thing. I suppose I had to look that one up. But there's, you know, this kind of amazing attention to detail. There is a picture which I got to in the very nice inlay eventually, but yes, so we get those kind of close studies of these things as well as they make their way along, and also lots of fascinating kind of historical references too. It seems that the packing technique was at least partly borrowed from how Jingdezhen porcelain kind of packers had done things over a very long period, right, from this kind of historic Chinese porcelain producing town, and a scale that is just extraordinary. So this decision, as you mentioned, has been made, and the first sort of outward shipments get made. So how did that go? Okay, next question. What was the sort of first trajectory out of Beijing, what in terms of taste of things to come, what kind of things did they encounter?
So in a slightly bizarre decision, they decide to send their first shipment of cases to Shanghai, which is odd considering the place has just been bombed the previous year. But the decision is taken by the Palace Museum that these 20,000 cases stuffed full of art will probably be safest in the foreign concessions in Shanghai. So they are taken by train in a very haphazard, badly organized, ineffectual effort. They're taken by train down to Shanghai over the course of a couple of months in 1933. And they're all stacked up in a disused hospital in the French concession on the Rue Montauban. And there they sit. For quite a while everyone tries to figure out what to do with them now. And overall, the situation in China deteriorates gradually. It's fascinating to note that during this period, when they're sitting in Shanghai, the museum is still trying to function as a museum. So they're actually taking objects, repacking them, and sending them off to London for the London exhibition of 1935-1936 during this time. They're still trying to live out their role as curators and trying to make the museum be a museum, even as the artifacts in their charge are all wrapped up and bundled and stacked in a disused hospital in Shanghai. And while they're doing this, they decide that they've got to build a proper storage facility. So they get to work on building a storage facility in Nanjing, in the Chao Tien Palace complex, which today houses the Nanjing Museum, Nanjing Municipal Museum. And by 1936, that's ready to go. And it's got a proper air-conditioned vault. It's bomb-proof. It's waterproof. It's got proper storehouses. It's a fully modern facility. And they move the cases to Nanjing by the end of 1936. Everything is moved to Nanjing. And they think it's going to be safe there. But of course, it's not, because 1937, all-out war breaks out.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Mm. Right, and Japan moves into sort of the rest of to northern China, and then increasingly moving further south to Shanghai, and then on to Nanjing. Now, it seems, yes, there were kind of attempts to, I guess, or at least one potential solution was this international safety zone, which was proposed within Nanjing, with some sense of what was going to happen when the Japanese attacked, and the possibility of trying to locate the treasures there. But I guess that idea also ends up being kind of suspended, and these almost 20,000 cases. Actually, I mean, as an aside, cases is the sort of unit of measurements that is used throughout the book. But what are we actually talking about when we say a case in terms of size? There is a picture of some stacked cases too, but in terms of scale, what is one case? Just so we have a better
idea. It's about a cubic meter. Yeah, I mean, it's a wooden case about a cubic meter, something like that, a little smaller maybe. It's got slats along the sides, and crucially on it, it's got a labeling system, which the curators use to keep track of what's inside every case and where every case is. And so that record keeping, the labeling system on the outside of the cases, is absolutely central to the whole story. The packing and the labeling were the two procedures around which this entire process worked, and if either of them failed, you know, these objects were going to meet with disaster. But they didn't. They held. The packing held, and the labeling system held throughout the story. And some of these cases are very, very heavy. Some of them contain these huge chunks of granite. You know, they contain jade, whenever you move them, and we talk glibly about moving them here, moving them there. Every time you move them, you've got to hire hundreds of porters just to pick them up, just to get them from out of the hospital onto a truck, you know, and then off the truck onto a ship or onto a railway car. It's the most enormous logistical operation, and it's very expensive too.
Well, I think the fact of moving one case and what that involves is in itself already a formidable challenge, which makes nearly 20,000 cases almost unintelligible, and all the more unintelligible when we consider what's about to happen, I suppose, which is this sort of tripartite journey to the West, domestic journey to the West within China that the objects all undertake at this point. So we've got these kind of three routes that you outline: southern, central, and northern, each of which is covered in a detailed chapter or two, indeed, throughout the sort of kind of middle to latter part of the book. So how was it decided which of these directions would be taken by which objects, or maybe it wasn't? I mean, maybe it was slightly random. But could you sort of perhaps first actually describe what those routes were and where things ended up? And then, you know, what went where, maybe, if that's a relevant observation too.
So by November 1937, these 20,000 cases are still in Nanjing, and the Japanese are literally miles away from the walls of Nanjing. And there is a last-minute, frantic, panicked effort to get the cases out of Nanjing to anywhere, to safety anywhere. So they are driven across Nanjing. They get to the docks. The museum hires Yangtze River steamships from China Merchants Group, the big conglomerate, and also from Butterfield and Swire, the British trading company. The cases are loaded aboard steamships, and they are taken upriver. The first two batches go up the Yangtze River. One then turns south on what's called the southern route, heads down into Guizhou province by steamship, by train, and by truck, and ends up at a little tiny township called Anshun, just outside Guiyang. And there the museum has found a cave, which is reasonably dry and is reasonably large and will provide suitable long-term storage and will be bomb-proof. So the first batch of cases, which is very small, it's only about 80 cases, containing some of the rarest, most irreplaceable pieces, end up going to Guizhou province. The second batch leaves Nanjing just a couple of weeks before the Japanese arrive. It goes the whole way up the Yangtze River to Chongqing over the course of a year and a half, staging as it goes in rickety, dangerous, damp, temporary storage facilities. It goes to Chongqing, then it goes through the Three Gorges on upper Yangtze River steamers, those little tiny ships that they used on the upper reaches of the Yangtze. Then it turns up the Min River and the Dadu River, where it's on bamboo rafts, being poled upstream and hauled upstream by teams of trackers who pull it using ropes from the bank. And it makes its way to a little tiny township called Angu, past the city of Lershan, out to Angu, where it's stored in temples and in ancestral halls. Again, that whole process is nearly 2 years getting from Nanjing to its final destination there. So it's in Sichuan province, way out in the Sichuan Basin, a long way from the front line, but still within range of Japanese bombing. And there it stays for 7 years. That's 9,500 cases, the largest shipment. The third shipment goes by what's called the northern route, and it goes by rail back to Suzhou and then west into Shanxi province, deep up into the lowest plateau, the whole way along that long, long, long railway line out to the town of Baoji. The rail line then stops. There's no more railway. So where are they going to go? They put these 7,500 cases on trucks, and they take them over the Qinling Mountains in winter, which rise to 12,000 feet. So they're driving these cases through the snow and fog and whiteout on these icy switchbacks over the Qinling, down, down, down into Sichuan province. And they end up in the town of Erme, at the foot of Ermeshan, the Buddhist mountain. And there they stay, also stored in ancestral halls and temples for 7 years throughout the war. So that's the broad disposition of it. And this movement, of course, mirrors the massive migration of people and government from Eastern China to Western China, which characterized the entire Chinese experience of World War II.
Mm, right, yes. And that kind of, again, grand scale kind of historical forces is something that is so palpable and so tangible in these movements at every stage, you know, whether it's people kind of fighting up through rapids at ever sort of shrinking rivers and rivulets and tributaries or coming over the mountains in winter, as you mentioned, almost at every stage. And I don't think this is just your, you know, sort of talent as a storyteller injecting this, but the kind of sense in which things seem to escape just in time, just before, whether it's a university in Changsha or some region of urban Chongqing or some area that gets bombed almost as soon as the things have left. It's really incredible that this kind of happens at all. But it happens, I guess, thanks to these amazing curatorial figures who, continue to be such a strong presence throughout the narrative. So you've got Ma Hong kind of overseeing it, as you mentioned earlier, and then Zhuang Yan, Na Zhiliang, and also this figure, Ouyang Daoda, these kind of key, I guess, protagonists in some ways of, or human protagonists, maybe to complement the object protagonists that dominate the narrative. How did you sort of, find getting to know them, and how did they generally sort of respond to their responsibilities? Were you kind of presumably pretty impressed by their ability to adapt to all of this stuff? But, you know, did their sort of human experience, how do you think it was sort of shaped by this kind of trajectory? That's a fairly open-ended question, but
These guys, the two curators that I focus, besides Ma Hong, my central figure, I sort of focus on three curators, two of whom wrote very accessible, very beautiful memoirs. So obviously that was going to place them front and center in my version of the story. The third curator, Ouyang Daoda, wrote the definitive account of the logistics of the entire trip. So you have two very personalized memoirs, and you have one very granular, detailed kind of accounting of everything that took place with lots of numbers and tables and stuff in it. And they form the sort of texture and the lived experience in the book. And I wanted very much to try and center their voices as much as possible. I want you to try and hear them and their and these sort of wonderful reminiscences of everything down to what they were eating, where they were sleeping, their endless battles with bed bugs, you know, the awful conditions on the road. Nadja Liang particularly writes, he's a very sort of rather hard-headed guy, a very strong sense of humor, very resilient man, very strong emotionally and psychologically. He writes beautifully about the details of life in quite a personalized way, in a rather sort of modest way. It's not a self-aggrandizing tone. Zhuang Yan is a very thoughtful, studious individual. He tells us a lot about what he sees as the sort of meaning of what he's doing. So we get an insight into their sort of their state of mind to some extent through Zhuang Yan as well. And lovely reminiscences of life in rural China in Sichuan in World War II. And I also got to interview his son, who remembered the whole experience. He was 87 years old when I interviewed him, but he remembered his childhood memories very clearly. So we get a rather beautiful, I think, picture of life as a child in rural Sichuan while this was going on. I have tried to make these people tell you the story. I've tried to lean into their experiences as much as possible, and I hope that works because they're both fascinating men with fascinating stories. Yeah, it was very, it was disappointing to me that we heard so little from the women involved. Families went with the curators. There were lots of other voices out there that I would love to have tapped, but the material just wasn't there. The women were not writing memoirs. They were not writing letters, as far as I could find. And so we miss that side of it. And when we hear about the women are always being narrated by men, which I found frustrating. But you know, it is what it is.
Right. Sometimes being left behind, sometimes being sort of summoned to follow along. I mean, that the kind of family management that is also sort of part of the...
an intrinsic part of the entire endeavor, but we don't really get a voice telling us sufficiently what that was like. We get some, but we don't get enough, in my view. Yeah. Mm.
No, well... In any case, as you say, that the kind of vivid sort of stories of these figures really does come through and make it all the more amazing, you know, that this was something that actual people did. And you sort of describe as well in very sort of deft detail the way that individual figures, whether it's Ma or Na or Zhuang, shuttle between the kind of various sites, these West China locations that these, as you meticulously note, 16,727 cases end up back in Western China itself. We also note that there are 3,000 further cases that don't actually make it out of Nanjing all the way back at the beginning of the trajectory. Of those kind of all those cases, they then do manage to find a sort of sanctuary, as you put it, in West China for that crucial period. But, you know, at some point, eventually, kind of devastation and cataclysms that have given rise to this westward migration do start to die down, subside. And around 1945, the war with Japan, of course, ends with the end of the Second World War. So what at that point are the sorts of stakes of this? What sort of decisions then face people after they've hauled all this stuff to the West? And what's the sort of path forward from there?
Well, then they've got to haul it all the way back, right? So they've got 20,000 cases of art sitting in Sichuan, which somehow has got to get back first to the capital, Nanjing, and then, as they would hope, the curators and Ma Heng would hope, it was going to go back to the Palace Museum, Beijing, back to the Forbidden City, and it was going to be placed back in its original context and its original dispositions in the place where it belongs, you know, that these collections belong. That doesn't happen. The cases get hauled all the way back up the Yangtze River to Nanjing over the course of about a year and a half. They go by naval landing craft the whole way back up the Yangtze River, getting very wet as they go. And they end up back in Nanjing. By late 47 into 1948, it's becoming clear that the Republic is not going to survive, that the Communist Party is making huge inroads, particularly in Manchuria. and the entire government of the Republic of Chiang Kai-shek's regime is under threat. And plans are being made for the government to retreat again, just like it did in World War II, to leave its capital and to go elsewhere. And a meeting is held in 1948 in Nanjing. The Palace Museum meets to try and decide what to do about the imperial collections. The Executive Yuan, Chiang Kai-shek's office, ends up handing down orders that the finest objects, the rarest objects, will go with the retreating government of the Republic of China to Taiwan. And our curators, who we've been following all this time, who've seen these cases through the worst depredations of war, are now ordered to split the collections. They're ordered to separate out the finest, rarest pieces and take them to Taiwan. So they follow orders and they do so. And the two curators, Zhuang Yan and Na Zhiliang, end up escorting nearly 3,000 cases of the very finest objects from Nanjing to Taiwan in late 48, early 49. And of course, the objects in those cases form the core of the National Palace Museum Taipei today. But we're left with this notion now. Ma Heng and Ouyang Daoda, the other curators, decide to stay on the mainland and wait for the communists to come. They decide to go back to Peking and back to the Forbidden City. So our characters and the collections are now irrevocably split, and none of them will ever be united again. And that's kind of how this story ends, or at least in my telling of it, that's how it ends, with the collections split between Taipei, Peking, and Nanjing. And these four men who've been together through thick and thin, never able to unite again and never able to sit around a table and talk again.
Yeah, well, it's really a personal, a very personal story of a broader kind of global event again. But also just back to the objects for a second then. As you mentioned, they've been pulled all the way to the West. They've come all the way back. I mean, is it really the case that at this point where they eventually do get split in the kind of late 40s period when the Civil War has resumed and the Communist Party are looking like they'll take over, is it really the case that they're almost all intact? I mean, that's even that fact itself seems extraordinary. But you mentioned things getting wet. There are various episodes at which stuff falls off trucks, or you know, things fall in rivers. Is it, what was your sense of whether there was any damage, you know, or kind of to what extent there were losses along all this way?
So in the sort of mythologized telling of the story, particularly in the People's Republic of China today, you'll often hear the line, "and not a single piece was lost or damaged or broken." That's part of the myth that surrounds this story, and it's not true. The very granular telling, accounting of the entire story by the curator Ouyang Daoda, goes into significant detail to tell us exactly what got broken and when and how, and a lot got broken. As a overall percentage of what was shipped, it was a very small percentage, but it still ran into the hundreds of objects. So, for example, at one point they're moving a load of cases in Chongqing into temporary storage in an old abandoned opium warehouse, and nobody's taken a good look at the floor, and the floor is actually rotten. So they stack all these cases up, the floor gives way, and these cases go crashing down into the basement, and a lot of cases are damaged, and a lot of stuff gets broken right there. And Ouyang Daoda lists every single object that gets broken. Ming porcelain gets busted, some Zhou period bronzes, their handles and their legs will get broken off, they get dented and things. On another occasion, a truck is crossing a level crossing, and a the driver doesn't look both ways before he does so, and a locomotive comes speeding down and crashes into this truck loaded up with cases, and a load of stuff gets broken then. Trucks are always overturning on the road, but by and large, the packing was so good that it held, and a lot of stuff got dropped, smashed, cases got smashed, but the packing held, and the stuff inside didn't get broken. So it was a remarkably effective job in maintaining the integrity of the collections. For texts and books and paintings, the real worry was damp and mold and bugs. And a lot of cases got wet, and there was an awful lot of emergency conservation where they would rip open wet cases and just take stuff out and hang it up to dry. Often it's kind of at the roadside or at the riverside, they were doing this to try and dry stuff out as they went. There was a lot of that. It was touch and go a lot of the time. And there was a lot of improvisation, snap judgments, guesswork. It wasn't a smooth, heroic process. And throughout the book, I have tried to avoid using a sort of heroic mode of narrative. And I've tried to lean into the kind of random, capricious, improvisational, always just being on the edge of disaster nature of the entire enterprise, because that's really how it reads to me, and you can feel it in the memoirs all the time.
Well, that's there right up to the end, even after this decision to move the most precious, irreplaceable, as you mentioned, objects to Taiwan. The basis of that decision, I think, is also an interesting one, curatorial decision to choose certain things as being somehow more valuable out of this, unbelievable number of things, something interesting to reflect on. But as you mentioned, you get then this sort of bifurcation and two curators remaining in China or on the mainland and two going to Taiwan. So how does the sort of splitting of the collection at that point get mirrored in the split experiences of the people involved? I mean, this sort of brings us right up to the conclusion of the book, and especially Ma Heng's fate.
Yeah, so the curators who went to Taiwan spent the rest of their lives in Taiwan and were, established the Taipei Palace Museum and lived by and large long, prosperous, happy, fulfilled lives. Ma Heng's story was rather different. He was, by the time the communists took over in 1949 on mainland China, he was already in his late 60s. And he decided to stay, I think, partly out of loyalty to the Forbidden City, but also just because he couldn't face the idea of moving to Taiwan and starting a whole new life away from everything he knew. In the early days of the People's Republic, and particularly in Peking, it's been slightly sort of memory hold, I think, that the degree to which China's intellectual classes had a very rough time at the start of the People's Republic. We all know what happened to them later on, the anti-rightist campaigns, and the Cultural Revolution, and the stinking ninth category of intellectuals and all. But actually, there was a lot going on in the early 50s, and particularly in Peking. And Ma Heng fell foul quite quickly of the early campaigns in those days, particularly the San Fan campaign, the Three Antis campaign. And the last few years of his life were lived in fear and in humiliation. He starts keeping a diary in late 1948, and you can see, so for the first time, we're hearing his own voice very, very late in life as he enters into this incredibly traumatic period. And I try in the book to draw out some sense of what happened to him and some sense of how it felt to be in Peking at that time. He writes a lot in the diary about the number of suicides that are taking place. He writes a lot about disappearances. You can sense this, the political terror growing. And then he ends up being taken away for interrogation in the context of the San Fan campaign. And it's really, I found it very difficult. I found it very painful, and it's a very sad end to an absolutely remarkable story of a remarkable, very modest, retiring man who was deeply devoted to conserving and preserving the imperial collections. Yeah.
And the sort of opening of a new chapter, which is not part of the book, as you mentioned, this is more or less the coda of it. But of course, then reflecting on, as you mentioned, those other kind of more well-known and severe political campaigns and so on that focused in many cases on old stuff, all the more amazing that things have made their way up to the present day, even without moving along quite the trajectories that you have charted for us today and in the book. But brilliant, Adam. Thank you so much for talking to us about this great piece of work today. We've taken up quite a lot of your time, but before we let you go, are you working on anything kind of new, a sequel, you know, something to show us what happened to the collections in their respective places? Or you've probably had enough of following them around. So what have you got on at the moment?
Well, as you know, as a commercial writer, you have to kind of move from one project to the next. So I'm currently looking around for my next project. I'm very taken with the sort of project that has been underway among historians in the last, I don't know, 10, 15, 20 years to try and recover this period of Chinese history and to try and rethink and rework China's experiences in World War II. There's been some amazing work done by historians like Rana Mitter and Hans van der Ven and Diana Larry and Peter Harmsen and Robert Bickers and all these terrific historians who've made us rethink what happened in China in World War II. And I think we are still to gain a strong public and popular understanding of China's place in World War II. I think we are very ignorant and impoverished in our understanding of what happened to China and East Asia in general in the Second World War. So I'm attracted by the idea of trying to work more on that, and I'm looking around for ways into that. And another story which one could tell that would allow us to use the granular story against the larger historical backdrop. Haven't found one yet, but I'm looking.
Okay, well, tips on a postcard then. We'll put the call out. Yeah. Great. Well, Adam Brooks, thank you so much for appearing on the podcast today. It's been great talking to you.
Thanks very much for having me. I've enjoyed it. Thank you.
Listeners, thank you too for listening, as ever, to New Books in East Asian Studies. It's a podcast channel on the New Books Network, and it will be back with you again very soon. Goodbye.